Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us again on a pre-presentation podcast. Today, we have a topic that is close to my heart because it pays for my meals, my vacation, my healthcare, and others, which is infectious disease in particular. What's to know about antibiotics for the primary care force? And I have the one and only Dr. Thomas Matt. Hello, Tom.
Hi, how are you, Lucio?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Good.
In case you don't know, we are two infectious disease doctors in CentraCare, and Dr. Matt is in St. Cloud, and he holds the big fort in there, and I hold the little fort, the extension of CentraCare here in Wilmer. So let's get right into it. You will be talking about antibiotics and what there is to know for the primary care force about antibiotics, correct?
That is exactly right, yes.
So within that big topic of antibiotics, how are you going to approach it?
Well, you know, we try to make it as clinically applicable as possible. As we both know, antibiotics are grossly overused, and sometimes that happens because people just don't know what they should use and then tend to go to the larger and mostly IV antibiotic therapy, which we both know is not needed. So the goal will be that people understand what antibiotics to use in what situation and what they get from certain antibiotics and what they should not use.
Yes. That brings me to the first, actually, that's a great intro to my first specific question. What would you say are the biggest misconceptions and mistakes when people use antibiotics?
Well, I think one misconception is that everything has to be given IV. And we both know, Lucia, that that is, of course, not the case, right? And so, and the other misconception is that antibiotics should be as broad as possible, which is also not what we recommend.
And that's interesting because there's the differentiation without empirical therapy and then narrow down therapy.
Right.
Can you think of any example in which a very narrow traditional therapy works great for something instead of trying to...
A typical example, Lucio, is cellulitis that I encountered being treated with vancomycin and meropenem. Mm-hmm. And the reason that is because after one day, the patient didn't get better yet. We all know that, you know, this is likely strep and can be treated, of course, with much, much more narrow antibiotic therapy, if not by oral treatment.
I used to have an attending in fellowship who said, if you scream out penicillin, streptococcus dies. That's how sensitive it is.
That's probably very true.
So one thing that I was wondering if you could comment on, sometimes what happens is that there are new kids on the block, they become popular and they get used. For example, new antibiotics for cellulitis and pneumonia. You know, we wonder, why is this needed?
Why it isn't, you know, and sometimes we see that really in a scenario when there's a new drug that's aggressively marketed. Thank God, you probably also noticed that our direct marketing to physicians has essentially been abandoned, which is very helpful. But it still happens in outpatient. A classic scenario is a broad-spectrum fluoroquinolone to be used for cellulitis, right, which we, of course, completely poo-poo that we don't want that. But I think I see that less in the hospital. I see more older antibiotics that are broader or, you know, combining different antibiotics for one indication, which really should not be done. Again, the classic scenario is adding vancomycin to almost anything when a patient doesn't get better without evidence of any resistance.
Yeah. And another way to put it, I think it would be like there are certain conditions that are common and easy to do a trial with. So
that's true.
But that doesn't mean we should use it for that. What do you say when somebody says, well, there are these antibiotics, why you create them if you don't want us to use them?
Well, you know, that's a good argument, right? Why you create something and I use it, but I should use it appropriately, right? When I use a new antibiotic that I want to use for a highly resistant organism, I'm happy I have a new antibiotic, but that doesn't mean I have to use that antibiotic for everything.
Yeah.
So new antibiotics should be used, anything actually, should be used as appropriate, not just because it's new.
Yeah. One of the biggest concerns with overuse of antibiotics is resistance. I know you're still under 40 years old, but even with that caveat, you've been practicing for a while. So that was a joke. You can tell how a German reacts to a joke.
I'm a German. I have no sense of humor. You should know that by now.
It's like nothing. It's like taking a deep breath. So from the time just... Let's say when you were in medical school or from the time that you had an idea of what resistance was and antibiotics, etc., have you, with your own eyes, seen that resistance is truly a thing in your lifetime?
Like evolution is not a thing either.
Let's not get into that.
You know, or global warming.
Well, it's okay. This is called the science of practicing medicine. So, yes, you can say it.
So, of course, both we know that, right? We have seen MRSA. When I went to medical school, there was no such thing as MRSA, right? It was completely unknown. VRE became just a thing when I was in fellowship. That wasn't known, right? And the more and more resistant gram-negative organisms, ESBL, a typical example, has become mainstream. Those are all things we have not seen previously in the previous decades, right? This is all known. Of course, it's related to overuse of antibiotic therapy. There's no question about that.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's one of those things that you had to do it in an altruistic way because you attempted to give the atomic bomb to your patient to save your patient, but then over time, how would you subdivide how are antibiotics overused in duration, type? How would you describe each aspect of overuse?
I would say all of the above, Lucia, right? I mean, antibiotics are grossly overused by using too broad-spectrum antibiotic therapy and for using it too long. And also overused by using broad-spectrum IV antibiotic therapy when an easy oral antibiotic is available. So there is no subdivision. I think overuse is happening in any regard. If I should say something, it's mostly length, right? So I often come by and an antibiotic just doesn't get stopped. I get the impression that once an antibiotic is started, nobody stops them.
Yeah. I would like to do a ping pong quiz because I think it's great that you are really to the point in the answers, and it's very useful because I'm sure people will love to hear ping pong of how do I treat this or that? Which, again, you'll be talking about the classes of antibiotics.
Right.
But if it's okay with you, let's get a little bit on, okay, so what do I do for this or that, right? So I'll take care of the questions, you take care of the answers, okay? So let's start with UTI, common offender.
Common offender.
How has the duration of therapy moved over time?
It has changed in terms of length. You know, we treat much shorter now for uncomplicated UTI as we have been. As you well know, I don't treat, well, first, I don't see uncomplicated UTIs. That is more something that falls into primary care. And usually with a 3-day course of antibiotics, that's well treated. If one chooses fosfomycin, one dose treats it too.
Yeah.
Okay? So we shied away from 5 days, 7 days. I always hear that from people, well, we should probably defer for 7 days. No, there's no evidence for that, right? So it has become significantly shorter.
And would you recommend that it's okay to sometimes your patient is better after a couple of days and
I'll stop it.
That's it? Can you talk a little bit in UTIs, what has happened with quinolones that fell in the back of
Well, quinolones, as you know, have been associated with resistance induction. Also, they have a fairly high risk of C. diff, right? And quinolones should be used as a second or third line antibiotic because, you know, we're creating more resistance. We're treating resistant organisms. I run into the problem all the time that people use a lot of fluoroquinolones and they come in and have now a fluoroquinolone resistant. Now it's a complicated UTI, right? And so, yeah, we should use more narrow antibiotics, not the most broad spectrum antibiotics just because they're convenient right away. That's the problem with the fluoroquinolones. They're easy to prescribe. Everybody knows them, and that's not what we recommend. We think before I prescribe.
And they have a pretty interesting list of serious complications.
Oh, they sure do. But of course, you know, the first fluoroquinolone that was marketed, Cipro, is a German one, so it's feels to my heart to use fluoroquinolone. No, I'm just kidding.
Is German?
Cipro,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a German development. But independent of that, it is has a lot of side effects. We both know that, right? From joint pain to hypoglycemia to arrhythmia. Not to mention there's lots of drug interactions with fluoroquinolones. And, you know, we can avoid them by not using them if you don't have to.
Sure. Now, another common, since we are in UTIs, your patient shows up with a UTI and has a gram-negative blood infection along with it. Does it mean much?
To me, yes, because you went from an uncomplicated urinary tract infection now to gram-negative sepsis potentially, right? This is a different treatment, right? You also have to look for more complications. You know, the classic scenario is a kidney stone, right? So you might need to get urology involved. You might need a stent. I mean, this changes the picture, right? But regardless, it's a gram-negative infection. If they're on appropriate antibiotic therapy, I usually don't get more than 7 days, unless, of course, they have an unremovable stone or a new stent or that's anything complicating. But that should not be primary care.
Those patients are already in the hospital. But again, this ain't for anybody can join, and we have hospitalists, primary care, etc. But that's great that you mentioned the 7 days because that's been proven and over again proven that 7 days is enough. So whatever happened with pneumonia, and I hear a lot, you probably do too, are still people getting IV antibiotics for 10 days for pneumonia. What would you say to that?
Well, thankfully, I don't see that anymore here. I think that has changed, right? As we well know, they can treat pneumonia now with 5 days or even shorter. And I always tell the anecdote when penicillin came around, you know, there was an issue of shortage when it came around. And people were only treated for pneumococcal pneumonia until the death of vest. And some people got 1 day of penicillin and got better, right? And so I think we might even see more shorter courses. I think eventually maybe we'll be able to treat pneumonia uncomplicated, right? We're not talking about empyema and other things. Maybe even with 3 days of antibiotic therapy, I don't know, okay? But no more 10 days. 5 days is, and we usually see that followed fairly strictly now.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We say a week, like, I don't know if we lived in pre-Gregorian times, we would choose 3 lunar days or whatever.
I don't know, Lucia. You know, I never understood why in the U.S. we always argued 10 days. You know, 10 days for pyelonephritis, nephritis, 10 days for cellulitis. That's an American thing. You know, Germans would say a week, right, or 2 weeks. But again, we know we have pretty good data, you know, as well as I do. Who am I talking to? You know what I'm saying.
I'm just asking the questions.
You know, we have pretty good data that often shorten is better than longer. You know, and we have data for the gram-negative bacteremia, we have data for pneumonia, we have data for UTIs, we have data for cellulitis, right? Short is usually better.
So cellulitis. You talk about using vancomycin for cellulitis. I'm talking when there is no abscess. Why is it wrong? What causes cellulitis?
Well, you know, cellulitis, as you know, it's either a purulent cellulitis or non-purulent cellulitis. The majority is non-purulent, and that almost exclusively caused by strep. Right, usually beta hemolytic strep. As we talked about, beta hemolytic strep will respond to beta lactam antibiotics, you know, from penicillin to NSAID to ceftriaxone, right? Purulent cellulitis is often Staph aureus, but only that would only require a different treatment than strep, mine of course not penicillin, if this is MRSA, which you would have some evidence for that, right? You would have a history of MRSA or you screen positive for MRSA from the nares. Most people when they come in with cellulitis are just fine served with NSAID or ceftriaxone, which treats Staph and strep.
So would you say that MRSA causing purulent cellulitis, by that I mean a skin abscess, is unlikely, and therefore the use for vancomycin is not necessary for garden
No,
variety cellulitis?
we barely see any MRSA cellulitis, generally speaking, right? Let's put it this way. And if you see Staph cellulitis, right, most often than not, it's not MRSA either.
It's
Okay,
MSSA.
exactly.
Because a common theme that I see is people who fail outpatient. I want your opinion on this. Fail outpatient cellulitis treatment. They get to the hospital and they get vanco, and what
Right.
they need is more time of oral antibiotic or just maybe a push with IV cefazolin or a beta lactam.
That's exactly right. Right. Patience is a virtue, right? And nobody gets better in a day or two when they have cellulitis. And I preach that like to the choir, right? You have to wait. Not everybody needs to escalate antibiotic therapy just because it don't get better in 48 hours. Also, there's lots of parameters to follow, right? What I usually follow is the fever because that goes away the quickest, right? It's not the swelling and the redness. That'll take time. But don't change course of antibiotic therapy if you don't have purulent cellulitis and you don't have evidence for MRSA. It just takes time. And you're right, IV is not better than oral necessarily. But, you know, as soon as they come to the ER after 2 days of Keflex, people get admitted and started on
And put
vancomycin.
the leg down and it gets redder and all that.
Right. So, of course, right?
Yeah,
Gravity. Yeah.
gravity is grave. Speaking of that, it's interesting that you mentioned the duration of therapy, because every time that you grab a classic book of infectious disease, durations of therapy are defined as, well, as soon as the patient is better, is not having fever for a couple of days and eating. So we can use that too, right? We don't need to stick to a week, stick to five
No, we don't.
days.
We don't have to. You know, and you know as well as I do that in many diseases we do not have a clear defined duration of antibiotic therapy. Right? There's just not enough data to support that. Some of them we do, like the gram-negative bacteremia, right? Post-surgical infections. But for some we don't. Yeah, if a patient has Staph of S, the Y count is normalized and they're getting better, they probably are not acutely infected anymore, and further antibiotic therapy likely, unless there's a complicating factor like a retained focus or whatever, can be discontinued. Yeah.
So, as per the presentation itself, you are dividing it in antibiotic groups, right? Beta
That's right.
lactams, quinones,
We
etc.
try to get some structure, right, so that they understand there's different groups and different indications. And then we also will talk about what antibiotic or what group of antibiotics can you use for different indications. But before you do that, you have to first have an understanding what the different groups mean and what they tend to cover and what they're not cover.
So, if I ask you for, the biggest concerns you have for, let's start with risk for C. diff. Which ones would you put at the top of the list? Some are famous, but some are not that commonly known for people.
Yeah, C diff on IV vancomycin, just out of curiosity, right? So as you well know, anything can cause C diff. And if I have to group the antibiotics I have the most respect for, I would say the fluoroquinolones. Okay. And, you know, everybody mentions clindamycin, but we don't use clindamycin much anymore. The other one, of course, would be broad-spectrum beta-lactam antibiotic therapy, right? Not everybody has to be on ceftazidime or on, let's see, zolcin and carbapenems. Yeah. So those are at least the most common offenders I see. But in general, right, if you want to avoid C. diff, the shortest course of antibiotics should be preferred in anything.
Or avoid antibiotics.
And avoid, exactly, and use the least broad ones.
I've seen ceftdinir used quite often, being...
Yeah, you know, I see that sometimes as an outpatient for pneumonia or when people are transitioned from, you know, they come in a hospital, they'll be treated for for community-acquired pneumonia, let's say, with pneumococcus. They get started on ceftriaxone and then they switch them to an oral third-generation cephalosporin, and then ceftdinir or cefpodoxime, you know, is used too, yeah.
And I think quite a bit of C. diff with it. It's like, I see, did you get ceftinia? I see it there.
It's a broad spectrum, you know, cephalosporin, yeah. I see that too.
Another one that we see a lot is C. diff. And you know, there's vancomycin and fidaxomicin, something that the outpatient people will come across quite often is like, okay, let's do fidaxomicin, looks great. The people go to the pharmacy, $5,000.
Yeah, I don't use it.
So,
a simple answer, right? We both know the recommendations, you know, but I want to play devil's advocate and said some of the recommendations are a bit driven by who pays your, you know. So the reality is I don't use it because of the cost. You know, people started, I know that happens with some of our GI people, they use it in the hospital because, you know, they don't think what will happen when those patients go home. And a poor hospitalist gets the pre-authorization. So no, I personally don't use fidaxomicin. I don't see there's much of a benefit. If people tend to relapse with C. diff, you know, that was the only argument for fidaxomicin, that it decreases the relapse. If they relapse, I actually are going fairly quickly to the stool transplant if I can.
Okay. Yeah.
And our GI department is very helpful in that regard.
Yeah, they are doing it in St. Cloud again, right?
I think so, yeah. At least I thought so. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong
they
here.
Are. So one thing that we used to see a lot when I was in training and wanted to see if you see it's getting better is the come with a head cold or otitis or sinusitis and get an antibiotic. Do you think we are getting better at that?
I think so. I think it took a while, but I think we're getting better because, you know, I had some talks in urgent care. The classic scenario, you know, that right, patients come in and they want an antibiotic. They don't feel taken seriously unless they're given an antibiotic. So I think we have come more to the point to explain to people that most of that is viral and we should not use an antibiotic for that reason. So I think, yes, I think we're getting somewhat better in prescribing, over-prescribing antibiotics for viral illnesses.
What about, do you have personal interest in knowledge of long-term consequences, especially when exposed to antibiotics in childhood?
Long-term consequences in childhood.
Yeah, you know, there are some loose associations with diabetes, malignancy, autoimmune diseases, and altering the flora with antibiotics.
Well, we all know that, you know, there's a especially in the GI tract on the oropharynx, there's a resident flora, which is healthy or not healthy, depending on how you alter that, right? We all know that. But I think this is all in flux, and I'm not sure, you know, that there's enough yet information available to address that. I would generally say you should avoid antibiotics. If you don't need them, you shouldn't take them. They have serious consequences, and some of the consequences we don't even know yet, right? As you know, I came across that child obesity might be related to antibiotic therapy as well. I mean, there's a lot of things that are in, or antibiotics in the water from, you know, using it in the industry to raise livestock, right? There's lots of terms. But no, I read it when I come across it, but you know, there's no hard evidence yet. I would say that we can say that.
What would you say are the biggest gaps in knowledge on how to treat something with antibiotics? And this is something that could be outpatient, urgent care / ER, or once a patient hospitalized. And you can divide it in syndromes or agents.
You can actually summarize it fairly quickly. The biggest gaps are what is a narrow antibiotic in comparison to a broad spectrum antibiotic, right? Sometimes that's difficult to understand. Number two is treatment length. Right? People tend to go more is better, and exact opposite, right? Less is better in terms of antibiotics most of the time. So length of treatment and what represents a broad-spectrum antibiotic, how can I de-escalate antibiotics? I think those are really the things I run into most.
Let me move in a little bit in etiologies and causes. What would you say to somebody who has outpatient diverticulitis? What would you use for that? Garden variety.
Well, outpatient, so you use oral antibiotics, right? So I would either use Levaquin and Flagyl or moxifloxacin, our German product, or you can even use Augmentin, right? I mean, you want to treat GI organisms, right? And outpatient, I would treat with oral antibiotics. There's really no need for IV antibiotics in outpatient treatment. Some people now argue you don't even have to treat any antibiotics, right? This has come around too, and you just wait. But yeah, generally speaking, I use oral antibiotics.
Okay, and for pneumonia, very similar
Very
what you
similar,
can
right?
use, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah. One thing that I see sometimes is, I don't know what you think about this, but I see two things that are risky. One is treating pneumonia with azithromycin when we have such an occurrence of pneumococcal resistance. And the other one is when people have cellulitis, the provider thinks MRSA. So they want to cover MRSA, so they give Trim-Sulfa or Bactrim. And in doing so, they may miss strep because it could be resistant to that.
Right.
Is that something you see as well?
Yep. Well, the azithromycin, we try to preach that azithromycin should be not used for pneumonia because, I don't know what it is in Wilmer, but I think we are about 20, 25% of resistance to macrolides now. If Bactrim, I don't use Bactrim for soft tissue infections at all, right? I just don't do that because exactly of that, right? Because of the streptococcal resistance. We also have now resistance in Staph aureus, so I don't use it. And so I try to shy people away from that. I usually run into that, Lucia, when people have allergies, right? So let's say they have this remote history of a penicillin or cephalosporin allergies and people then get Bactrim. That scenario, I still don't use Bactrim. I use, other medications that are available, maybe even linezolid if I have to for a brief course, but only in documented allergies. But no, I shy away from Bactrim for soft tissue infections. Not to mention a lot of those people are elderly, and then people don't think about the potential hyperkalemia they cause.
So last realm of questions. What conditions in the hospital first you think they should ask you for advice for sure?
Sepsis,
Okay,
right?
sepsis, but sepsis can be white count of 15,000 and
Well, a real sepsis, right? Positive blood cultures,
I love that. Real sepsis,
right?
not BS.
I mean, a real sepsis, right?
Yes. Okay.
Gram-positive bacteremia with Staph aureus, right? Because it has so dire consequences if you don't treat that appropriately or do or look for any trainable sources. Unexplained fever. Okay. Or people that don't get better, before you think I should use meropenem, an ID consult would probably be appropriate. That doesn't mean you shouldn't use meropenem in the middle of the night if somebody comes in with you suspecting gram-negative sepsis. But if a patient doesn't get better on antibiotic therapy and you start thinking I should broaden them, I think I would call for an ID consult first.
Okay, and you mentioned gram-positive cocci. Would you include enterococcus in the
Yes,
blood as well
absolutely.
to call you?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and depending on what kind of strep, they can cause trouble too. So,
Right.
do you think it's fair to say any gram-positive
I
cocci in
think
the
so. That's fair
blood?
to say. Worst case scenario, it will be a one visit and say it's everything is fine, right? But at least,
Okay, how about meningitis?
of course, of course. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that, right? Of course, we should see any
Okay,
case of meningitis, right?
how about for outpatient, what patients they should send you for outpatients?
You want to mean the ones I get or the ones I'd love to see?
The ones that you love, you should.
Well, fine. First, we should probably send people that have FEO. We should probably see them. I also think it's often a very interesting workup, even if it often turns out not to be an infectious illness, right?
You mean fever of unknown origin, you mean?
Fever and origin, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
If you have refractory or recurrent cellulitis, because more often than not, those people do not have cellulitis, and we can save them many, many antibiotics in the future, right? If you have recurrent or complicated urinary tract infections, and you have been on numerous antibiotics, and now all of a sudden you're growing ESBL, that would be worthwhile too, because yet again, often those people don't need antibiotics at all. Okay. If you have, of course, the standard things, we see HIV and everything else, right? Any people that are immune compromised and have fever or infections or transplant patients that, before you start, broadening antibiotic therapy and maybe an ID outpatient consult is advisable. But again, it can go on and on and on. There's many things we should see in a clinic that we currently don't see.
So the last question, kind of a trivia question. What antibiotic is irrespective if it's broad spectrum, not spectrum, what antibiotic you think is a great antibiotic and what antibiotic you think is useless, worthless?
Well, I am a big fan of penicillin, maybe because okay. I treat so much syphilis and cellulitis. Of course, it's not a broad spectrum antibiotic, right? But it's very safe, it's well tolerated, can be given by continuous infusion, and does work for its indications, right? I like cefazolin. I like that antibiotic fairly well because it treats, you know, the standard gram positives and is fairly well tolerated. As far as the most useless antibiotics, doxycycline for cellulitis.
But for other things, but how about one that is like never found its niche? It can be in or out patient.
Jesus, what never found its niche? You know, all antibiotics have their niche somewhere, right? Even if you won't like Bactrim, I use it for PCP, right?
Like, yeah, what about, I always joke, remember when tigecycline came out?
That's right. I thought it's in the orcus of, you know, bad memory. Or, you know, the other one you can also bring, remember Sinocid?
Cinacid, quinopristin, dalfopristin.
That's right. You know, yes. That also has, you know, I remember when they came around and all of a sudden we have this new miracle drug for VRE and didn't really work well and you had to have a central line. And
I only used it once when I was a fellow because it was almost disappearing by then.
Yep.
And I remember one of the toxicities was arthralgias. And
this patient. Oh my God, it was horrible.
Yeah, and this patient was like, oh, this is horrendous.
That's hopefully gone. No, tigecycline, right, as you know, has also been proven that it's actually quite inferior and it causes increased yes. mortality. Mm-hmm. So probably not something you should still consider.
And I like that when it came out, it was a doctor walking with a tiger, tiger seal, and I think the tiger ate the doctor in the end.
Right? Yeah, that's true.
So, anything you would like to add before your really, really looking forward to presentation?
Yeah, first, I'm of course not looking forward to the presentation. You forced me into it, but nonetheless.
Thank you.
You know, that's your influence. But no, there's really nothing I could at this moment, you know, come to my mind that I want to add. Okay. Just for maybe a sentence, use antibiotics wisely. And if you don't know how to use antibiotics wisely, call an infectious disease consult. We'll be happy to help.
Okay. Well, I'll make a confession here. I'm really looking forward to your presentation because, as you know, I always ask you for advice, and I'm still waiting for the day in which you will ask me for advice other than in how to play soccer or make a barbecue. So I'm really looking forward to your presentation. I think it's going to be very well received because it's been something that people have been asking for. So again, this month, March, we will have Dr. Math, the one and only, talking about antibiotics, their indications, when you should use them.
And when not.
And when not to use them. So thank you for that.
Anytime.